From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal. Tenderloin.
Treasure Island. Richmond, California.
Coming up, a controversial gas and oil extraction process has some wondering what's going on underneath our feet.
You know, it doesn't make me feel better to know what's going to poison me. You know, I want the poisoning to be stopped before it happens.
And San Francisco high school students are wondering what's in their water pipes.
It's pretty dirty. There's a, I don't know what's in there, but it's pretty bad.
Also, we'll remember the man who couldn't know enough about Oakland City government.
You're violating the equal access provisions of Proposition 59, the Ralph M. Brown Act, the City of Oakland Sunshine Ordinance, and the U.S. Constitution.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. After a series of earthquakes near Youngstown, Ohio last week, some observers are pointing to an unusual culprit. Yesterday, seismologist John Armbruster told NPR that he thinks the quakes were related to an oil and gas extraction process called fracking.
Youngstown is an area which doesn't have a history of earthquakes. This disposal well started operating in December of 2010. 3 months later, the earthquakes begin.
Industry and government experts estimate there are hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of natural gas in various shale formations across the country. Some people think there's enough to meet the country's natural gas needs for the next few centuries, assuming we can actually get to it, which is where fracking comes in. Here's how it works. Companies drill deep into the ground, a mile or two down, into shale, a hard but porous rock with little pockets of gas or oil speckled throughout. Then they inject highly pressurized frack fluid, a combination of water, sand, and chemicals, to break up the rock and release the oil and gas. Fracking has touched off something of an energy boom in this country, but it's controversial. Last year, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found chemicals commonly used in frack fluid in a Wyoming town's water supply.
So now we have the smoking gun.
Environmentalist Bill Aliyu says the biggest problem with fracking is that we just don't know that much about its long-term effects. But it's happening right now in California. KLW's Christopher Connolly reports.
Riding around in Chris Rather's golf cart, you can see about a dozen horses grazing on his ranch near Los Alamos in northern Santa Barbara County. It's a quiet patch of the valley, surrounded by vineyards and farmland.
We have a training track up the hill.
40 horses eat a lot of grass, and that means they need a lot of water.
We're fortunate in this valley to have a wonderful supply of water and wonderful quality water.
A few months ago, Rather's neighbor called him up. He had some oil wells on his land, and companies had drilled there before. But lately, there'd been a lot of new activity, and it seemed different.
And I said, oh, don't tell me. You know, don't. Even before he said, did you know that, I said, you're not going to tell me they're fracking.
They were fracking, but for oil, not natural gas. Rather had heard about the practice, and he wanted to make sure that his water would stay clean.
Once it's damaged, it's damaged. It's game over. You know, and without water, we don't have a business. We don't have a livable place to live. And that would be true of everywhere that shares that water supply.
I think it was kind of a double shock in a way.
Doreen Farr represents Los Alamos on the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors.
One was that that this would happen without anybody really knowing about it, without there being some sort of notification to the county in the form of an application or whatever.
In other words, oil companies didn't have to tell anyone that they were fracking.
But also, I think even kind of the bigger surprise that it was happening any place at all in Santa Barbara County, or that we had the geology that would make fracking attractive to an oil company.
Farr says she and others in the county thought fracking was a natural gas thing, and there's not much gas in Santa Barbara. As it turns out, though, they're right on top of a huge shale formation that spans four counties in central California. And it's filled with oil, 15 billion barrels, enough to meet the whole country's needs for at least 2 years.
It's a hearing to receive and file a briefing on hydraulic fracturing as a means of enhancing extraction of oil and or gas from subsurface formations.
So Doreen Farr arranged for a number of hearings at the County Board of Supervisors. She invited residents, state officials, and oil company representatives. She wanted to find out how common fracking was in Santa Barbara and what the risks were.
And I think, you know, the primary concern has had to be with the any effect that it might have on groundwater, and particularly in Los Alamos, all the people.
They learned that only two wells were fracked in Santa Barbara County. But they also learned that state regulators don't keep any records on where fracking happens. What's more, the industry doesn't have to disclose what chemicals are used in the frac fluid. They're considered trade secrets.
Well, if we want to test for this, we don't even know what to test for. You know, you can't test for everything.
There's not a clear path under California state law or federal law to figure out where fracking is happening.
Brian Sagey is a staff attorney with the Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara. He says when oil companies frack in California, they file the same paperwork they would for traditional oil and gas wells. Since they usually frack in wells they've already drilled, the state doesn't require an extra permit.
And it's hard to even piece things together afterward, but clearly there has been no prior disclosure, and that's what we saw in northern Santa Barbara County.
A few months before all this happened, California fracking had caught the attention of a national nonprofit called the Environmental Working Group. Bill Aliyu is their California representative.
When I asked him about it, there was a pretty clear-cut answer, and it was, we don't frack in California for gas because we don't need to.
The them he's referring to are the state regulators. They work under the Department of Conservation, and their official name is the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. But everybody calls them Dogger. Aliyu says what they told him is technically true. Gas fracking is rare in California. But that's only half the story.
We've been fracking for oil in this state for 50 years. Not gas, but oil. We first fracked a well in California in 1953 in Los Angeles. The world's record frack occurred in California in Kern County in 1994.
Aliyu says not only is fracking still happening, it's happening all the time.
Oil companies openly said, oh, we've been fracking for 50 years. They're not hiding anything. They do that as a matter of routine on at least 50% of the oil wells in California.
He wanted to know why Dogger hadn't mentioned the oil fracking.
I could not believe how head in the sand they were, or they were outright lying. I couldn't figure this out. Why are they not telling me what's going on?
Dogger declined to be interviewed for this report. In an email, they said they have no verified information about fracking in the state, but that they don't believe it's widely used. The Western States Petroleum Association, an industry lobby, says Californians shouldn't be worried about fracking. Tupper Hall is a spokesperson for the group.
There are huge amounts of regulation and frankly, a great deal of understanding built up over the years by the oil industry about how to protect that groundwater.
Hull says it's impossible for fracking to affect the water supply because it takes place so far below it. And all oil drilling, fracking or not, goes through the water table.
That's why well integrity, about which there's a huge amount of regulation, is the key to protecting groundwater in a hydraulic fracturing circumstance or any other drilling circumstance.
Hull also defends the industry's refusal to be specific about how they make their frac fluids. He says people don't understand the importance of trade secrets.
Companies that develop processes and utilize very precise recipes for hydraulic fracturing have a very legitimate concern in protecting those precise recipes. You and I, as consumers of energy products, benefit from that competition, and therefore those protections are in our interest. That's not the oil industry's point of view. That's the state of California and the federal government's point of view. We happen to agree with it.
There's still a lot of debate about fracking's environmental effects, and the EPA is still studying it. In the absence of national legislation, states have started to regulate fracking on their own. A bill pending in the California legislature would require companies to disclose what chemicals they're using and how much fracking they're doing. But they wouldn't have to say where they're fracking for a few years after the fact. The bill has a lot of support. Tupper Hall says the Western States Petroleum Association is behind it, as long as there are safeguards for trade secrets. Back at his ranch in Los Alamos, Chris Rather says that wouldn't be enough for him.
You know, it doesn't make me feel better to know what's going to poison me. You know, I want the poisoning to be stopped before it happens.
In Santa Barbara, at least, he's got his wish. Late last year, county supervisors voted to change the zoning code. Now, if oil companies want to frack, they have to apply for a separate permit, hold a public hearing, and produce a full environmental impact report. Rather says he's happy with the new regulations, but he's still suspicious of the whole fracking business.
You know, we're not anti-oil. We're not anti-oil company. We just want to know it's safe before it happens here, because the consequences are too high.
For Rather, those consequences mean his whole way of life.
When I wake up in the middle of the night and in a cold sweat about something, it's usually about water. Anything that has to do with water, to me, is just like absolutely the most important thing in our lives.
California Senate plans to take up the fracking disclosure bill early this year. Santa Barbara is still the only California county with any fracking regulations. For Cross Currents, I'm Christopher Connolly.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil caps fill and bringing jobs to small towns. So everybody's willing, people turn on the lights, and the drill is making killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranks, fishes 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like
Christopher Connolly is a reporter at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. You can find more information about fracking and read Dogger's full statement on the issue at our website. We're klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now we'll move to a different kind of pipe, the kind that carries our water. The Bay Area has some of the cleanest tap water in the country, but that doesn't mean it's always appealing to drink. California recently passed a law requiring schools to provide students with fresh water. But as Youth Radio's Sarah Cavedo reports, giving a teenager water doesn't mean she'll drink it.
A couple months before California's new law came into effect, I asked my high school principal, Carmelo Scarlato, what he knew about the mandate to offer free fresh water at lunch.
How aware of SB 1413 are you?
I am not. Excuse me, I am not aware of the bill.
But even after I told him, Scarlato said there are lots of other upgrades that would come before water at our school.
Ventilation, way more important in this building because we have no windows that really open. Repairing leaks to cut down on mold buildup. Those are two major areas that I would put money into before water.
Plus, according to both state and federal law, our lunchroom water fountains put my school in compliance with the new water policies. But in the eyes of most students I spoke to, like my friend Jesse Chen, water fountains are nasty.
I wouldn't want to use it.
Why?
Because it's pretty dirty. I don't know what's in there, but it's pretty bad.
And she's talking about the one working water fountain in the cafeteria, which is covered in stains and which you practically have to make out with to get a drink. Throughout the school, there are signs above most fountains that tell us to run the water for 30 seconds before drinking. And both the custodian and my principal told me janitors run the fountains every morning for 15 minutes to flush the pipes. Makes you wonder how fresh the water really is. I decided to find out.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey.
Come on in, guys.
That's Darlene Franklin, a researcher at San Francisco State University.
Of course I expect contaminants. I expect microbes on there because so many students, I'm sure, probably put their mouth on there.
Yeah.
Come on, all their hands? You never know.
Franklin gives me a bunch of sterile containers, latex gloves, and disinfectant wipes, and shows me how to collect samples.
So, got my two samples from this school, and getting some weird looks from people for talking into a microphone myself.
A week later, back in Darlene Franklin's lab, we run one last test. After a few minutes fiddling with the microscope, she and her lab partner, Kimberly Suey, finally see something.
Oh, no, there they are, there they are.
Good.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm all excited. This is the best part. You get to see them. I got them. They're beautiful.
Kind of beautiful, if you're into that sort of thing. But more to the point, the little yellow blobs are mostly harmless. They're micrococcus colonies from a fountain in my school's hallway. It's a skin bacterium that can, under certain conditions, cause pitted feet. Gross, I know, but safe to drink at the levels we found. And anyway, it's not just the bacteria students worry about.
I hear there's tons of lead in the school's main water system, so I try to shy away from that.
In case this guy, Aiden Offerman, is onto something, we also tested my school's water for lead. All the samples were under the 20 parts per billion that would take it out of service under EPA guidelines. So at my school, at least, we're better off drinking from our rundown fountains than hitting the vending machines for quote-unquote juice drinks. But that's a hard sell, given student perceptions like Issa de Fusco's.
If I was very, very thirsty or felt dizzy, I would probably go and drink some, but I avoid it pretty much at all costs. Honestly, a lot of the time at school I'm thirsty and I don't drink water.
And kids aren't totally crazy to worry. Researchers have found elevated lead levels in school districts from Philadelphia to Seattle. And with no federal policy requiring schools like mine to test their water, it's hard for thirsty kids to know whether the supply is safe. So until water fountains, like elevators, get little plaques certifying they pass muster, plenty of students won't trust the free fresh water in their school cafeterias, policy or not. For Cross Currents, I'm Sarah Quevedo.
Sarah Quevedo is a reporter with our partners at Youth Radio and Turnstile News. What do you think about school water supplies? You can join our discussion at our Facebook page. We're KALW News.
Oh, ask them for water.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. In the last week of 2011, a man named Sanjeev Handa passed away. KALW's Rena Palta tweeted, Oakland City Council meetings will be a lot less interesting. It's a sentiment shared by many people. Handa, who was 55, spoke at nearly every meeting of the Oakland City Council for two decades. He went to subcommittee meetings and commission meetings, he researched legislation, and he dogged city officials over every rule violation. He also introduced himself the same way every time.
Mr. Handa?
Again, for the record, Sanjeev Handa, he's from News Service.
From our archives, Sandhya Dirks brings you this profile of the man known as Oakland's gadfly.
Oakland has basically a congestion management plan that is from the 1970s. It is antiquated.
The man standing at the lectern in Oakland's elegant city hall is wearing shabby jeans and a coffee-stained polo shirt.
There are several points that came up, and I want to run down a quick list.
This is Sanjeev Handa. He's addressing the city council, and this is where you can find him most of the time, talking on any and every topic.
The idling of ambulances, Oakland Fire Department trucks, the delivery trucks, often for 30 to 60 minutes at a time.
With his bad comb-over and shaggy reporter flair, Handa isn't afraid to raise his voice or to rail against the council members.
You're violating the equal access provisions of Proposition 59, the Ralph M. Brown Act, the City of Oakland Sunshine Ordinance, and the U.S. Constitution. So let me just state that up front.
He's got a permanent place at the press table. Handa is a one-man news team. He's the sole founder, editor, and writer of the East Bay News Service. And he's been publishing since long before the internet made bloggers commonplace. Handa has always had a lot to say.
He has an absolute right to say what he wants to say, but his energy is extremely draining. Ineffective.
That's city council person Nancy Nadal. Handa is often called the gadfly of City Hall, and Nadal says that's true. His words often sound like a lot of angry buzzing.
He does sometimes have a kernel of truth in there and a good idea in there, but if it's always put out in an attack mode, it's just not heard and not responded to in a way that's effective.
But Handa describes himself differently, as part government watchdog and part citizen journalist. And he says he's on a mission to make Oakland city government as transparent as possible.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you doing?
Great.
I meet Handa before a recent council meeting. We're in Oakland's cavernous city hall, and it's almost like he's inviting me into his living room.
Okay, come on in.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
And it is like his living room, because Handa basically lives here.
I have been at every council meeting except one since 1992.
And I've missed a couple of committee meetings here and there, but I've been at almost all committee meetings and most of the boards and commissions, the key ones at least.
For Honda, it's important that everyone be involved in the democratic process.
If you're going to have a democratic society of any kind, you need free-flowing information. And you need somebody to provide objective background so people can make up their own mind. I often speak at these meetings, but I never take a position on a project or a cause or anything. I'm just speaking to the process issues and trying to get information into the public domain.
Back at his press table, Honda is waiting for the meeting to begin, and people are starting to filter in.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Fellow community activist Jim Dexter walks by. He checks out Honda's box of day-old pastries.
I'll go for it.
Dexter grabs a donut and tells a story about just how outraged Honda can get at the antics of city committee meetings.
He was so upset at what the committee had not done correctly associated with the procedures surrounding the Brown and Sunshine Act.
The Brown and Sunshine Acts are Honda's battle axes. The Brown Act was originally passed by the state of California in 1953. It requires all local government meetings be open to every citizen. Honda tells a story about the lengths he went to get the Oakland Museum to open up its board meetings.
I spent a couple of days in the city clerk's office, made them pull stuff out of their dusty storage, and they pulled out like 38 banker's boxes of documents. And in box 22, near the back, was the file on the Museum Foundation.
You can just imagine Honda pouring through boxes and boxes of paperwork. It sounds like a scene out of a John Grisham thriller, but Honda wasn't looking for the elusive evidence that would free his innocent client. He was just trying to get a museum board meeting made public. Still, he found what he was looking for, proof that the Museum Foundation was subject to the Brown Act. And that's not the only law on the books that requires local government transparency.
In January of 97, the City of Oakland City Council unanimously passed the Sunshine Ordinance.
One of the things the Sunshine Ordinance calls for is advance publication of agendas and staff reports of all committee and council meetings. Soon after Sunshine was passed, Honda tried to get some reports. When he ran into trouble, it marked a turning point for him.
So I showed up at the city clerk's office, and the then city clerk, Sita Floyd, basically slammed the door in my face, saying, it's 5 o'clock, I'm going home, the reports aren't ready. And I think that's where my crusade or battle first just started, that I'm somebody who just doesn't let go. And until this is working smoothly, I feel that's one of my missions.
Honda doesn't let go, and he doesn't forget. He remembers everything. That's because Honda talks to everyone.
The reason I'm able to actually articulate what goes on and have a better handle on what's going on is I talk to staff, because I'm not pushing an agenda. I'm not advocating for a project. I'm not looking for a contract. I'm not pushing a council member. I'm not looking for a job. I had one staff person tell me the other day, I was passing on a piece of information about a community meeting that was coming up, and he looked at me and he said, you know, I get more information and more support from you than I do from most of my colleagues.
He says his mission for transparency in city government is more important than ever before.
In the mid-90s, at an Oakland City Council meeting, you would have 15 to 20 journalists. You would have two reporters from the Tribune and one or two columnists. You would have a Chronicle reporter, somebody from the Examiner, somebody from the now defunct, or not defunct, but cut back Berkeley Voice. The list went on and on and on. And as time progressed, all of those have disappeared.
Honda believes that the crisis in journalism is directly linked to many of the scandals that have beset the city in recent years. He also believes that no story is too small.
Your issuing of parking tickets as well as the...
So Honda keeps on showing up at City Hall and publishing his newsletter. It's a newsletter he started in print almost 20 years ago that now goes out over the web. In this way, Honda is the quintessential citizen journalist. But what he also suggests is that the future of journalism isn't so different from its past.
Thank you.
From pamphleteer to blogger, independent reporters like Honda may be the last one standing, often at the lectern, berating the city council on yet another point of contention. I'm Sandhya Dirks for Cross Currents.
Sanjeev Honda died late last month. That piece was produced in October of 2010. And if you remember Honda, you can let us know by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. Or you can get in touch through our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Chris Hoff, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Nina Morente, Joaquin Palomino, Katie Steyer, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Cross Currents theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear how one San Francisco school is giving kids the tools for success. Literally.
This is a kindergarten where you know that your child is going to learn how to use a drill.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing is by The Secret Identities. They'll be at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco on Saturday. Music starts at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
I try not to bend her, but I'm just too strong. I think of the future, then tomorrow comes. I pick at our sutures, then tomorrow comes.